Welcome to The American Innovator on KGMI, a show about you and your ideas, paid for by FastCap, a lean-thinking company spreading innovation across the country.
Good morning, everyone. This is Paul Akers and John Lussier on The American Innovator, and we've got a great show today and a lot of fun stuff to talk about.
We have a guest today, Jim Vadalero from Productivity Incorporated, that's going to be with us here shortly. And they have a phenomenal website. They've got tons of tips as far as how to implement lean.
And well done, too, the way it's laid out.
It's very pithy, and we like that when things are very, their brevity is involved. And their tip 42 is Lean 5S. The first S sort is about asking a series of questions. What is it? How often is it used? How many do we need? Do we really need this many? Do we even need it at all? Anyone should be allowed to ask these questions. And yes, as far as in that, that reminds me of learning to see and talking with Jim earlier, that their company, that's what it's really all about, is teaching businesses how to uncover the truth and go to the shop floor.
Uncover
get
the you, truth.
Get you can boot.
I always say 90% of what you do is waste. It's a staggering thought. And we have a waste expert on the phone, Jim Vadalero from Productivity, Inc. Jim, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to share perspectives this morning.
Jim, let's start off with telling people a little bit about yourself. Tell us your background and where you came from and how you got involved in Lean.
Sure. My background is in the aerospace manufacturing engineering. I learned Lean at the Boeing Company for 4 years under the tutelage of a team of Japanese consultants that were members of what's referred to as Taichi Ono's Autonomous Study Group. And their approach to teaching Lean, I think, could be safely characterized as tough love.
No kidding. You know, I've heard that a lot, Jim, before. I'm not used to seeing, I haven't seen that too much myself where they've been really brutal, but I've heard that, you know, when they walked into Harley-Davidson to turn Harley-Davidson around, they did the same thing. They were pretty, pretty upfront, and you had that same experience. Tell
us about
what
happened. What kind of tough love did you get?
Well, one of our very first projects that we tackled at the early in the process of implementing Lean at the Boeing Company was in their 767 wire shop, and I had the great fortune of being one of the four team leaders in that particular Kaizen event that was being led by the Japanese consulting team. And at the report out, you know, we went into it, you know, really cocky. We thought we had a great story to tell. We had dramatic improvements in inventory reduction, manufacturing lead time, quality, as well as productivity. So our team, we went up first. We had all of our stuff laid out on flip chart paper, had a great story to tell. At the conclusion of our report out, the lead Japanese consultant walked up to our flip charts and wall area where we had all of our stuff staged, and he ripped everything off the flip chart and off the wall, crumpled it into a big bundle, put it on the floor, and then proceeded to stomp on it for about 20 seconds.
And, whoa, that's tough.
The moral to the story there was, even though we had all these dramatic improvements, their perspective was, well, you know what, that's the way it should have been all along. You know, all you did was some basic, you know, rebalancing of lines, you know, and although, you know, in all those categories, the amount of waste was improvement, their perspective was just, you know, that's how it should have been all along. Now let's take another look at this and let's do it again. And that's when the light bulb went on for a lot of us.
And how did that light bulb, what did it look like? What did you see? Like, I want to get your first impressions, because here you are, as you said, a cocky engineer. You've been well-trained. You're working for Boeing, one of the premier, if not the premier, aircraft manufacturer in the world.
Besides Bombardier.
Yeah. They're much smaller, but they're definitely good. And then how does that all go through? Because that's a fascinating story. What did that look like in your head?
Well, obviously the first thing that takes a hit in your head is your ego. And that's one of the, that's the beauty of the logic behind the technique, you know, kind of reflecting back on it is, you know, companies have been just been so well entrenched in terms of how things have always been done before. And, you know, what does a team of executives from a car manufacturer know about how to make military and commercial aircraft? You know, we're the experts in this. We've been doing this forever. And it was really just a fundamental process of learning to see. And the first thing to get over is the ego and say, hey, guess what? You know, there's a better way to perform work. There's a better way to work together. Now let's collaboratively take a look at it. And oh, by the way, you as engineers, you do not have exclusive license on creativity and innovation. Learn to reach out to the people with their hands actually on the product and harness their ideas and their creativity and embed them into improved processes as well. And that was a bitter pill to swallow. You know, again, we're all humans. We all have egos, but we got over it quick.
We have a great saying we always go over time and time again, and that is humility is the path to greatness.
Yeah, if you get that ego in there, it can be a little tough. And yet you were able to humble yourself, if you will. You backed off. What was the catalyst that caused you to say, well, maybe I don't know it all, and maybe I can learn something, and maybe somebody else does know something that I don't know? What happened there? Why did you come to that conclusion?
We had one instance where we were working a project, and it was a quality improvement project, and it was ongoing for several months. We were using the Six Sigma DMAIC methodology for it, and we were trying to improve quality, the quality rate associated with the cosmetic finish on a particular product family that had a dismal quality acceptance rate, and it was always being rejected for cosmetic blemishes. And one of the individuals that came out of the sales function in the group asked that old dangerous question that begins with the word why, and that is, you know, why do we need to paint this particular product family, you know, at all? And, you know, sure enough, the idea of not painting it, because, you know, keep in mind the majority of the team was engineers, was kind of met with initially with some skepticism, but through some strong facilitation, you know, the idea was not discarded. You know, it didn't die on the vine. And it was pursued, and sure enough, you know, this particular product family, it didn't need to have the finish on it at all. So we were solving the wrong problem. And it's a very humbling experience. And, oh, by the way, the idea didn't come from the engineering community. It came from an outsider that can ask that old dangerous question.
Why. In the sales department, is that correct?
Yeah.
And so what happened, I'm just curious, when this individual came up with a solution to a long-standing nagging problem, how did they feel? I'm curious. Because they weren't engineers.
No, they weren't. Well, initially, there's a little bit of intimidation. You know, you're not the subject matter expert, and you are the fresh set of eyes. And just initially, just getting those types of people to participate and to ask questions, you know, that's a bit of an obstacle and a hurdle in itself. But, you know, once, again, it all has to do with proper facilitation. You know, everybody participates 100%. However, the team will move forward on 80% agreement.
So at the end of the day, you've got this part that's been painted. It's got some kind of defect, a scratch or a flaw in it. Everybody's trying to figure out how to solve that problem so that you don't have to continually reject this part. And what was that part? Just curious.
This was a condensing can that actually went into the lower section of the fuselage. It was actually part of the whole air conditioning system, and it was a condenser. And sure enough, didn't need to be painted.
You mean it didn't need pen striping, hey?
Nope.
Cosmetic that nobody's ever going to see once it's in its dark hole.
Yeah, it got buried so deep inside the airframe, and it was, you know, corrosion-resistant material to begin with, so it was just a paradigm that it needed to be finished in the first place.
You know, some of the most revolutionary things that we've actually done at FastCap is not what we've done, but what we stopped doing.
Yeah, as Matthew A. May says, it's the art of subtraction.
Yes.
So beautiful. There's so much waste, so much over-processing. So that is the waste in that case. Was that correct? That was over-processing, Jim?
That was it, and it was a real light bulb for the team because, you know, the waste of over-processing is one that a lot of people have a difficult time getting their minds wrapped around. And it was just a classic question of, you know, work, effort, and resources being expended that wasn't necessary in the first place.
Right. A great example of overprocessing was our Sheriff Rutherford in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes.
They copied down the VIN number 17 times, I believe it was, on every police report. And when they became lean thinkers, they started asking themselves, well, why am I doing it 17 times? Can't we just do it one time? Can't we just find one place that information is always garnered from rather than 17 different locations? And they said, lo and behold, and we know the story, what happened there, $30 million in cuts or $30 million in
savings,
excuse me, no layoffs, all union people. A fabulous story of overprocessing and how it just affects every aspect of our life. And I'm sure you see a lot more of that as well. Give us some more examples. Do you have any more, Jim, of great lean things that happen, maybe even from people outside of engineering or inside engineering?
Well, there's another great one inside the world of aerospace engineering, and one of the early projects that we worked on was a commercial spacecraft, a rocket booster component. We wanted to use that as a control product to perform the classic waste walk on it. And in this case, it was a virtual waste walk because of the distances involved. But come to find out, when all was said and done and we tallied up the measures such as the number of inspections, the number of touches, and total part travel distance, we learned that this particular solid rocket booster component traveled more in its manufacturing process than it did when it was shot to an orbit of 1,200 miles above the Earth.
Wow. Wow. That's holy staggering. Man,
the listeners know a little bit about what your company does. Jim, tell us about Productivity, Inc.
Sure. Productivity Incorporated is an international consulting and training company that was founded in 1979. We started out as a publishing company. Our founder went to Japan and was the first to translate into English the knowledge of a group of Japanese improvement thought leaders, and as a result started Productivity Press, which soon thereafter led to Productivity Inc. Consulting.
And tell me about those. Who were those thought guys from Japan?
What is it? The thought leaders?
Thought leaders. Excuse me, thought guys.
What does that mean? Who's that? What's a thought leader? Somebody that leads somebody in thought?
Well, now these are the leading thinkers. These are the people that actually participated with Taichi Ono, who's widely considered the primary architect of this thing we refer to today as the Toyota production system and lean manufacturing. He surrounded himself with a group of individuals in actually designing the Toyota production system. People such as Shigeo Shingo, who was the team member that bought the SMED methodology, which stands for single minute exchange of dies, and it enables organizations to significantly improve the velocity of their product by changing over more frequency and getting away from lower batch size. So Shigeo Shingo was a member of the team. Dr. Fukuda was a member of the team. He brought structured problem solving into it. So these are the types of people that I'm referring to when I said the thought leaders involved with designing the Toyota production system.
Wow, that's fascinating. Let's talk about Shingo real quick. So what is the story behind what happened with Shingo in changing out systems? Because that is a powerful story for FastCap, but too, that I'm going to tell after you tell me how Shingo got going on all this.
The acronym is SMED.
Yes, the acronym is SMED. It stands for Single Minute Exchange of Dies. And what was happening in the sheet metal manufacturing process at Toyota was because they had these long changeover times, it forced very large lot size productions. And what's consistently observed as lot sizes and batch sizes go up is quality goes down, decreases, the lead time increases, which is unfavorable, which means the responsiveness to your customer is decreased because you can't be as agile, you can't be as flexible, you can't make, you know, what you want in one piece flow type fashion. So that's what the key to changeover is. It's really getting inventory turnover and enabling a much higher velocity of material the value stream.
And just for our listeners, when Paul and I went to Japan 5 years ago, we went to the Lexus factory. It was amazing to see that every 56 seconds a car was coming off the line, and it was a red car followed by a blue truck followed by a yellow Lexus. I mean, it was like you think about changing dies. They had to keep stamping out parts for every single different. They didn't like batch a whole bunch of trucks together, all red trucks.
Yeah, it was a Gumby production line. Flexible like I've never seen in my entire life.
It removed all the excuses for FastCap as far as why we can't do one-piece flow.
Exactly. So what was the exact – is there a story behind Shingo? Because I don't even know this story in terms of what happened. So they had a die they wanted to change, and what did he do?
Well, it was a process of discovery for Shingo. He didn't go into it with the answer in his hip pocket. He actually had to discover – the SMED methodology and worked with the team at Toyota in the sheet metal stamping and fabrication process to actually discover it. You know, methodology starting out with number one, first step in the methodology is to make the observation, go out and time it and lay out the individual elements of the changeover process. And once you're kind of looking at it in its discrete pieces, you start to ask some fundamental questions. And question number one is the observation that was made is when the changeover time started, For the first many, many minutes, I think it was the first 26 minutes in the initial study that he did, nobody was there. And he thought, well, that was kind of interesting. How come nobody's here? All we're doing is just sitting here looking at this particular piece of machinery. Well, the short answer turned out to be that everybody was out there doing their go-gets, and they're doing all these activities that could have been done with some forethought by, you know, while the machine was still producing its last few pieces of the previous production lot. So that was step number one in the methodology, and that is whatever can be done up front, get it done so you don't have all these go-gets and you don't have all these wastes.
And then what waste is that? Because we always like to tie it in. So that is the waste of waiting, isn't it?
That's the waste of waiting.
So they're sitting there waiting for everyone to bring all the things so they could actually do the change out. And again, I like to emphasize, these are smart people running this company, correct?
Right. Yes, they are.
These are the best and the brightest, and this kind of
These kind of improvements is everywhere. Everyone always thinks it's some magic crystal ball thing, but when it comes down to it, it's all very simple stuff. And we like to call this net time, no extra time. Like Paul and I read tons of books, and we're basically listening to books on tape while we're doing something else. So there's no extra time involved. And so this is a perfect example of that.
Exactly.
One of the things that Shingo discovered very early on is the recognition that people perform the work the best way that they know how. And in order to improve, one of the things that has to happen very early on in the process is the guilt has to come off the table. One of the things that Shingo discovered is that, you know, people have been performing this changeover process in these facilities that he was in for 20, 30 years. And suddenly you're going to come in and tell me that I've been doing it, quote, wrong all this time. Well, the answer is no, you haven't been doing it wrong. You've simply been doing it the best way that you know how. Now let's work together and discover the next best way.
Excellent point. You know, the same thing happened at our facility. The first thing that Gemba Research did when they came into our facility is they looked at our shelves, and they were just full of finished goods and inventory. And they said, why do you have all that there? And we said, well, because that machine over there that we make our product with, it's very difficult to set up, and it takes about 45 minutes to get it running good parts. And they said, well, we're going to figure out a way to make just in time what you need. So in other words, your customers order a particular product. We're going to make it that day, and we're going to ship it and package it that day. And I said, impossible. It can't happen. I said, well, let's go take a look at that machine. It took us 45 minutes to set the machine up. And in 1 week, they had it down to around 5 minutes. And I was naysaying them the entire time. I said, it can't be done. And yet I had just won business of the year. We had just been told by the bank we were the best manufacturer they'd ever set foot in, the most disciplined, the most orderly, the most organized, the best run company. We were making money. We were young and hip. Yeah. We had everything in the world going for us. Everybody said, wow, look at FastCap. And these Japanese guys come in and say, clueless.
Yeah, the funny thing is, this is a machine that you actually designed, retrofitted.
All me.
I mean, you were the father of this machine. And someone from the outside says, no, you're not doing it right.
Yeah, and I'd been doing it for about 2 or 3 years at that
point. Hello, check your ego.
Yeah, and boy, that's when the light switch clicked on for me. Literally, I was in the dark, and the light went on. I go, oh my gosh, if I'm doing this on this machine, I must be doing the same thing on everything else I do. And at that point, I said, lean, baby, I get it. I get it. There is no end to improvement. And I'm sure this is what you see everywhere you go, Jim. People, when that light switch goes on, it's just like, wow.
So it seems like the key is to learn to see. So, Jim, how do you get your clients or the staff to learn to see, to flip that light switch?
Well, you can't do it from a conference room. You can't do it from an office. You can't do it in a training facility. You actually have to go out to the workplace and literally teach people to see. It sounds like a very simple thing to do, but one of the things that we observe when consulting with organizations and with teams is that people initially are just trained to see and notice just the value-adding aspects of a process. And it doesn't matter if it's a manufacturing process or a transactional or intellectual knowledge-oriented process. People are hardwired, they're pre-programmed, predispositioned to just notice the value-adding aspects of the process. It's almost like the non-value-adding stuff, it never happened. And
That's interesting. I never thought about it that way. So they just dismiss all the stuff that's waste. They just focus on, hey, the machine happens to be making parts right now, but 10 minutes prior to that, it was doing nothing. Is that what you're saying?
And it's almost like there's a conscious human decision that has to be made with, you know, what level of magnification are you holding over this process as you're making your initial observations? It's a question that we're frequently asked, because with a very low level of magnification in terms of studying a process, you won't see much, which means it's, well, now it's an opportunity to crank up your magnification and definition of what are individual elements of work, what are tasks. In order to properly see it.
I like this idea. Now, this is a concept I've never heard before, Jim, the idea of magnifying the process so we can kind of take a good look at it, just like a doctor does an MRI or a CAT scan. We want to look inside and take a look what's really going on. So the person that's making an apple pie, if you will, they just see them actually slicing the apple and cutting the apple to put it in the pie. They don't see all the associated waste, all the traveling and walking all through the kitchen and all the things that are non-value. They just see them cutting the apple, if you will.
Yes.
Okay, we have Neil on line two. Neil, sorry we took so long to get to you there. Neil, go ahead.
Hey, here's an interesting story and kind of fits into what you're talking about. I have an older laptop computer, and my charger quit working. So I went around to the big box stores with like $100 for a kind of universal charger that would fit the thing. And being a cheapskate, I went home and cut the cord apart and kind of soldered it back together and made it work temporarily. But I got online, and I actually ended up buying a replacement charger for this computer through Amazon for $3.49. $5.75 to ship it, $210 total. And I'm just wondering, I just looked on the back of the new charger. It's made in China. But I'm actually going to go back just for fun to the box stores and find out where their $100 charger is made, because I suspect it's made in Japan as well. But I'm just wondering, how could a company possibly even make it in Japan produce something for that price? And I mean, I gave my debit card and the thing showed up in my mailbox 2 days later. But it's just incredible to me, the price difference. And
Well, there are a lot of things going on there. Number one is, you know, you've got the brick and mortar, and that's not cheap to do. You've got a retail space that's not cheap to do as well. And
there's also a lot of that stuff on Amazon is used too. Kind of like we probably have four of those chargers in one of our 14 containers. Yeah. If we could find it, we would have given it to you.
We probably have about 40 of those chargers just going to come over. We have a whole box, a gigantic box of electronic junk that we've accumulated.
It's
pathetic for sure. So I mean that's part of it for sure. But one of the other things is I was just reading a book, and John and I have been reading a book called A Whole New Mind, and the author says, you know, he holds up a fly swatter, and this fly swatter, he says to the customer, he says to this group that he's speaking to, he says, well, how much money did it cost to make this fly swatter? And people raise their hands, say, you know, 10 cents, 11 cents. Yeah. That's right.
Right.
And then how much money did it cost? How much money did this fly swatter cost? People say $4. No. $5. No. $10. No. $14. That's obviously margin and the cost of doing things. So your question was, how do they make things so cheap? You know, when you really get right down to it, the raw materials involved in a lot of products are very minimal. And sometimes things are marked up quite excessively, but Jim might have a comment on all this as well.
Sure. The economic reality today is that market value minus cost equals profit. And what we have to do in instances like this is to be sure that our value stream, the assets that are in it, and the business model that we're operating with are all structured around that economic reality and being able to achieve a target cost that would result in a profit that makes sense to us. So in instances when we have legacy assets, legacy infrastructure, legacy costs, it in many instances is going to force a fundamental rethinking of the business model to discover the answer to the question, if we're going to be profitable with this particular product or product family, how does the business model have to be taken apart and reassembled in order for it to work, in order for it to make sense?
So in other words, the big box store, in order for it to work for their business model, they have to charge that much. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and you know, they can ask for it, but are they going to get it, and is it going to continue to be a reliable product for them? I mean, ultimately, the market's going to answer that question.
And that's the beauty of the free market. It's going to constantly drive costs down and drive quality up.
And maybe not in this scenario, but we had another great scenario. We actually had a customer trying to compare one of our products that sells for $75 against a competitor's that sells for about $40. Well, our product is almost twice as much as theirs. But you know what? We took both those products side by side, and guess what? Ours works, and theirs doesn't. So this goes back to Toyota. Toyota is probably one of the most expensive cars out there. The question is, in the long run, quality is cheaper in the long run. So you take a Charger. There's a lot of these Chargers made in China that they've actually caused fires. So let's say, I'm not saying that's with this Charger, but let's say hypothetically we look 3 years into the future, this thing starts smoldering, causes a fire, burns down somebody's house. Now at the end, was it worth $10 versus $100 when you're talking about hundreds of thousands? So quality definitely saves in the long run.
So
yes, and on the other end of that extreme, we've got to be careful about over-engineering, over-specification, and embedding features and characteristics that adds cost, but in the context of the marketplace is not willing to reward you for it. So it forces a whole other series of questions to be asked as well.
Right.
Exactly. So let's go back to how you get people to see waste. You take them to the shop floor, to the Gemba. And what happens next, Jim? What do you do when you want to get people to see waste?
What has to happen is the waste has to be presented to them in the context of the work that they're doing. I mean, what their hands are touching, how their feet are walking, how their minds are thinking, with how they're actually doing the work real time while they're doing it. I mean, you can talk, you know, philosophically and conceptually about the seven wastes, but in order to get it to click, one of the things that lean organizations do really well is their supervisors and their leaders and their managers, they become teachers. And very early on this list of things to teach the people that are adding value to our products and services out there is what is value adding, what is non-value adding, but to do it right where they're actually doing the work, to give them the opportunity to ask questions and to give the opportunity for supervisors to learn a new skill set that they're going to have to be very proficient at if they're going to be a lean company as opposed to a company that does lean things. And this new proficiency is becoming teachers.
Exactly. And part of becoming a good teacher is the Socratic method. The teacher is asking a lot of questions, getting the student to answer the question, correct?
Drawing the solution out of the student.
Yes. And never give them the answer.
Because what is the greatest moment of learning?
When you guessed wrong.
And why? Why? You know, we have so little time left. I want to develop that in 1 minute. Why is guessing wrong so powerful, Jim?
Because ultimately, what gets impressed and imprinted in the human mind, which is, you know, simply a very sophisticated pattern recognition system, is people remember their mistakes a whole lot more than they remember their messes.
That reminds me of a Jim Dobson interview that you
listened
to. Right.
Just recently, I was listening to Jim Dobson, and he was saying, you know, if you were to raise your hand in a group and say, are the most powerful lessons you've ever learned in your life, did they not happen when you made a mistake or when you failed? And everybody in the room agrees 100%. So we constantly are trying to keep people from failing instead of allowing people to fail, because that's at the point of where real learning occurs. As one teacher had, or one principal had on their on their desk, it said, our job as teachers is to prepare the student for the road ahead, not to prepare the road ahead.
For the student.
Yeah. So we want people to understand life is not perfect. There's failure involved, and you got to deal with it. Jim, we only have a few seconds left. Tell people how to get a hold of you, your website, and all that good information.
Oh, you can reach us at www.productivityinc.com. And you can also feel free to send us emails. All of our contact information is there online, and we'd be happy to share perspectives or engage in a dialogue regarding improvement or innovation with any organization.
And your website has a wealth of tips and information free for the taking. You also have subscription base where people can actually take some courses online. So a phenomenal site. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
And we'll see you next week on The American Innovator.